trying something that new. I think generally, I mean, obviously, you know, that's a sweeping statement, but I don't think people find life-changing hobbies and careers at the moment where they're completely fulfilled.
Satisfied, yeah. Yeah. And had you been going to see lots of comedy? How did you know what to do?
I went to the Bearcat Club, which is where I did my first gig, which is in St. Margaret's, near Richmond, which is outside London, in England, in Europe. How am I doing for references?
Yeah.
I'd see something happen, make a connection, say what I saw, and then people would laugh, and I realised gradually that I was definitely seeing the world from an unusual perspective.
But there is a fine line between seeing the world from an unusual perspective and just being mad, and just seeing, so there's got to be a degree of translation or a degree of reference that other people get.
Yeah, your view of the world. Everyone laughing and looking at me in a slightly kind of, oh, how did you come up with that way, isn't obviously a sign of madness, it's a sign of people
they
appreciating
recognize it.
The thought process. Yes, I mean, you could say that it's a slight bit of madness in your brain that makes you make those connections, but then, you know, it's the same madness that makes people invent the telephone.
I think what I'm trying to say in a roundabout way is that there are some, let's call them care in the community people, who get on stage and think that because their view of the world is so unique, the audience will find it funny, and the audience just looks bewildered.
Yeah, but they don't get past the first hurdle.
No, but that is, to me, the line between comedy, is when the audience laughs.
Yes, okay.
It's comedy, and when it's just somebody giving their view of the world, which doesn't make any sense,
right,
it's something else.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, I think people are deluded that the fact that they are unusual makes them a comedian, but it just makes them unusual. But, you know, a comedian has to be aware of every thought process pretty much the audience are having to be ahead of them, like a magician. You have to know what the audience are thinking to be able to be ahead of them.
And lead them along your path.
Yes, set up mazes in their brains for them to go down.
So then what happened after you did this sixth gig from Up the Creek, which is notoriously
tricky? Especially back then.
Back then, yeah. It's become slightly less so, but it's still got reputation for it.
It has. I agree.
You left crying.
I left with a tear in my eye. And I carried on.
What were your thought processes? Did you think this is me, this is them, this is... because you were a bad comic?
Well, I've done 5 gigs, so 5 out of 6 is a very good percentage. It's the ones who have 19 out of 20 that I worry about, because they're the ones who will go, if they carry on. I remember one person, I'm not going to name them, obviously, but when I started out, that person would blame the audience every single time they had a bad gig, every single time. Barbara Woodhouse, who, as you know, is a very, was a very famous dog trainer on television, an eccentric character, said there are no bad dogs, only bad owners. Now, I know that may be a slight generalization, but it's a brilliant phrase to go
analogy,
by.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, yes, to use it as an analogy for audiences, there's no bad audiences, only bad comedians. You can go, well, what about 20 people in a 400-seater venue and they're all drunk and the act before you's got overrun and done badly and annoyed them and people are walking out? Yes, that's not a good audience, but a great comedian will turn them into a great audience. Make the best of it. You know, and you walk away, you know, I used to do it. I'd walk away from a bad gig and go, well, that's because that. But now, 13 years later, when I'm in that same situation, I will turn the gig on. And therefore, looking back on my first few bad gigs, yes, those situations had happened, but I still could have done something. I just didn't have the experience to do it. So now when I'm in a bad situation, I walk away and I think, I wonder what I could have done to change that. Every now and again, doesn't matter how many gigs you've done, you will find a situation. There's a weird variable and you go, don't know what to do now. Your brain goes, don't know what to do now. Because it's a case of just your brain going, I mean, you don't even know, it's like a chef is writing the right ingredients suddenly. You need a bit more of that. Just some, you know, it's more thin slicing when your brain just... A gut reaction where you haven't even intellectualised something. You're just gut reactions to do that, then that, then that. And it happens in all professions. And a comedian with experience and who listens to that kind of that gut reaction, it's not in your head, it's in your stomach, will know what to do and know exactly how to turn the gig into the right gig to do what they want to do. And every now and again, I'll find myself in a situation. You know, there's so many, you know, for example, if you're getting a hostile heckle in a quiet gig where you have only just walked on stage, for example, that's a very delicate situation because small audiences almost have to be on your side for the gig to work. Because it's always like, what's the point of, you know, I've done a university gig where we've
sitting down. You've been there, you've been there.
I've been there.
It was a disco, basically. And they decided to have a Pop Idol type thing in the middle of the comics. And I said, no, we'll do them in the beginning. And they had this series of steps which were so high that the girlies had turned up with their dresses and stuff. And I literally had to physically lift them onto the stage. They did their bit. They were terrified. It was awful. They were just switched off the whole, on every level, the whole thing switched off. And I was walking around with the radio and I just did the material and did the thing to the 10 people sitting down. The comics got up and they all fell by the wayside. They couldn't cope with it. We wound it up. We got paid. We left. It was awful. But in my, afterwards I was deconstructing. I thought what I should have done was with the radio mic gone into the audience and actually walked amongst them. And I thought it was an opportunity I missed to experiment with that idea because I've never done that before.
So next time you're in that situation,
next
you'll do
time,
it.
Exactly, exactly. And that's what I think is so difficult to explain to people, that it's almost like ballet. You've got to do it and do it and do it and do it. And the more the unexpected happens, the more you know how to do it instinctively. It doesn't become effort anymore.
Well, as you say, you can do, and that's not take the gig in the front.
Well, there's well, you see, I consider that a wasted opportunity. I was so annoyed with myself.
Sure.
I hadn't tried it because it didn't matter. I couldn't have done worse than the situation was set up to be anyway. I could have like done something else, but I was deconstructing. And I think that audience might have been turned around. How could I have done it? And I didn't use that opportunity because there will come a time when that will happen again, and I will have to use that as the first time.
Which is why I don't believe in comedy courses.
Why don't you believe in comedy courses?
I think you've got to touch a hot kettle to realise you shouldn't be touching a hot kettle.
This goes back to then material, because the comedy courses, some of which lead you to have at least material written so that you can go on stage at least with material.
Yeah, but anyone who's got, okay, but anyone who's got what it takes to be a comic would have watched a few comedians at comic clubs before doing it, because that would be arrogant to not do that, and then anyone with half a brain would have worked out seeing that, that you've got to have some material. I mean, if you think you're, they're making up as you go along, that means you seem to be very skilled comics or you're very to write a new saying each time we went out there. That's why I did my first three gigs. But at least, which, why would I not know that? Because I didn't see comics twice. But, I mean, okay, it's possible that somebody could not know you've got to write new material, but I think you'd be pretty silly to not have watched a few comics before doing comics. I mean, a girl came up to me at a gig the other day and said, I'm thinking about doing comedy. What advice have you got? And I said, well, get a tape recorder and record yourself doing your material. Play it back a few times, so that way you'll get your your rhythm going, and they'll hear it. Play it to some friends in a room. Just, you know, if someone laughs at the set recorder, then you're doing all right. She said, oh, well, I'm quite funny down the pub. I think I'll just get up there and just talk. And I really advise you not to do that. Yeah. You'll find it's not going to work.
My friends find me hilarious.
I mean, it can be done when you've done comedy for a while. Do your material, then drop your material.
that physically I'm really going to just, you know, collapse, and to get through that a few times. And then, I mean, I don't know whether it gets easier, but it gets more manageable. Do you still find that you have a high nerve rate when you go on stage? So getting back to material, what happened about the material then? How did you build up your material?
Just by being obsessed with the new world I'd found and looking around all day thinking. I didn't ever sit down to write material. Apart from radio shows, I don't do that myself even now. I just hope that my brain will be fertile enough on a daily level to think of funny things and write them down. I try a lot of ideas out that come to me on stage and bounce them around on set. Because I think you're funnier on stage than off stage because you have to be. There's that kind of, you know, what's that, sink or swim kind of thing. You know, the audience are looking at you, and if I bring an idea on stage that's half-baked, I'll get a punchline out of the bit that I couldn't find a punchline to. The right wording will come out, because your brain works faster under pressure. If you're suited to comedy, that's where you're, you know, I mean, if you're not suited to being on stage and thinking faster on stage than you do off stage, then you should be a writer, stick to the office, typing away with funny thoughts. But, you know, a comedian should be someone who works under pressure, because that's the environment you're working under.
When the adrenaline kicks in, you know what to do with it.
Yes, yes.
And turn it into something. So do you improvise much?
On a good day, 50% of the show. On a bad day, 10%.
So improvisation is a large ingredient in your comedy?
Yes, I find that if a gig's going extremely well and I'm just bashing out material, I start to think I'm cheating a bit, because it's the audience are up for it. I got the jokes, they already work, the audience are happy. It's kind of almost, you know, like pulling a prostitute, do you know what I mean? Who are you kidding?
I've never done that.
Nor have I.
Actually. Like the Comedy Store or Jongleurs or whatever,
right,
and you've got a 20-minute set, do you go on with a 20-minute set prepared?
No, never do.
You never do?
No, I go on with a box of records in my head and I DJ my way through. I've got my favourite records, I've got records I only play at the beginning, I've got records I only play at the end, but I often don't know what I'm going to say when I get to the mic. I've got two or three opening lines that I happen to have at any one time, and I'll pick the right one as I walk up. Because then you feel the mood in your head and connect with the audience. And also, /, it's like I'll go coffee / outside / bus. Or bus driver, you know. I might even go bus driver with bad attitude or something like that. But or bus driver / attitude, bad attitude. But the thing is that quite a lot of the time I looked at those and go, what the hell does that mean? And at the time I thought the third note, like, you know, the third reference, the coffee outside bus driver, I thought the third one will stop me ever forgetting it, but it's not the case. So, because, you know, there's so many things you think you're going to remember, but you don't. So really I should have written down, you know, more detail so it was never, ever forgotten. There's a beautiful Rolls Royce just a Bentley just gone across. Look at that.
Stunning.
It is stunning.
That's what you see on the Strand. Beautiful, beautiful people, beautiful cars. So what about writing for other people? Have you done that?
Yeah, I've written for other people, but very short bursts, but either for a day or 2 days, no more than 3 days. Someone's editing a show, someone's a TV show, just...
writing for yourself and writing for someone else?
Well, writing for somebody else, you have to think about what makes them funny and their persona, and there's a big difference between a joke and a joke for someone. Because a joke for Tommy Cooper wouldn't work for Bob Monkhouse. You know, it just wouldn't. One's got a silliness and a clowniness and a buffoon-like character, and one's got a smugness and a slickness and a superior character, and one, you know, very rarely the other. But my house is a bad example because he did have a kind of just these are jokes that I've written, like Jimmy Carr, here are some jokes. Although there's still an underlying persona, they're not as heavily persona driven as someone like Tommy Cooper or Eddie Izzard when they've got extremely
essential.
You know, Jimmy Carr is in a way the new Bob Monkhouse because he does almost come across as a person who's telling you some jokes rather than here's a character. There's character within the jokes, the cruelness, the poshness, the smugness, but the bottom line is someone like Tommy Cooper, it's just a force of a type of personality, and it doesn't seem as prepared, or it doesn't, you can almost imagine Tommy Cooper being in any situation at all and still being like that, whereas someone like Bob Muggins or Jimmy Carr, you can imagine the real personality popping up occasionally between the jokes. But I think that the absolute sign of a great comic is a joke that only they can tell.
Yeah. Well, again, with Tommy Cooper, sometimes you could take away the lines and it would still be just as funny.
Yeah.
Not quite a mime, but there's a degree of, like, you know, he doesn't... The words are almost immaterial.
Well, yeah, Woody Allen got it in a sentence. He said, a comedian's a funny person doing material and not a person doing funny material. And people come off stage and go, that was a great joke. Yeah, well, why didn't it work then? Saying anything, except for Tommy Cooper. But these are people whose personas, you know, if you look at the book of Hancock's Half Hour written in script form, has got Tony Hancock in a hat and overcoat, sitting at a table, eating a potato, and he's got a knife and fork in his hand with his little fingers held out, so he's showing the, you know, this kind of pretentious self-image of being graceful and upper class, but he's eating a potato with his overcoat on. You know, that speaks volumes about the character.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were doing stand-up, were you aware of what your persona was, or was that something that gradually came to you as time went on?
It gradually came to me, and I had influences that I shed and started to find myself. But I was aware very early on when I wrote a joke that was out of character with what I was doing at the time, at least. And my style gradually evolved and became what it is now, but I still... my head fell off, then I'm instantly pretending I'm not
consistency to it. So
exactly.
It's sort of, yeah. So what would you say your persona is on stage, or what aspect of it is that you project when you're on stage?
I'm intense, I'm enthusiastic, I'm mischievous. I've got an overactive imagination, not absolutely wildly what the hell's he on about, but, you know, bang, 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 bounce, bounce, twist, turn, we've ended up somewhere unusual. But it's always from the perspective of a person who you actually can talk to and know. I will never say the other day I went to the moon. But I would say if you went to the moon.
Just for its own sake.
Yeah, a little twinkle to say I don't mean that if I do say something that's cool. Too much comedy seems to be... I think people are so insecure about not fitting in with the audience. They alienate somebody in the world so that they can... It's like almost a school bully technique of, you know, and no one wants to be picked on, so they join in with the person picking on somebody. And I think that I don't want to be that comic.
Shanghai and places like this. What? How do you prepare?
I haven't actually been to Shanghai, but I have been to a lot of those, Singapore and Thailand, Thailand and Hong Kong, Tokyo. But what I find is when I go to a new city, because there's a whole lot of new things you're seeing, there are new connections in your brain, and therefore new jokes. So I tell you what's interesting, I've been to the Edinburgh Festival to perform about, I've done 7 Edinburgh shows, I've been up there 4 or 5 times, just popping up to do a few gigs. So I've been to the Edinburgh Festival 12, 13 times. Now, I haven't got one joke about Edinburgh as a city. Within the first 2 days, got a short joke or routine about that city. The reason I think I haven't got one about Edinburgh is, when I first went up there, I was extremely new, and although when you're new, you're having loads of ideas, they weren't necessarily good enough to keep or good enough to really put my set for one. So I'm now used to Edinburgh, so when I go to Edinburgh, I don't see anything new. So it just seems ironic that the city that I've spent the most time in outside of London is the only city.
Towards Britain, so I don't fall into the trap of saying the obvious knee-jerk things that maybe other people always say, because that's another thing I find. Again, well, in London you're sport really, but you get people from Australia who keep going on about, you call this a summer, you call Brighton a beach, people are not friendly, and you're sitting there going, yeah, it's all true, but it's not new, it's not, it's an obvious thing. Somewhere like Japan or, you know, South Africa, for instance, of which, you know, there's a lot more familiarity with South African culture than there is with Finnish culture.
Well, my joke about Cape Town was about the fact that in pool halls, you leave a deposit on the cue ball. So it's quite an obscure reference. It wasn't about the shape of the country, do you know what I mean, or the name of the town. I would won the joke by the promoter or the bartender at the club. Someone who's watched comedy a lot. I would check that it's not an obvious thing to say. I mean, I suppose I pride myself on not having obvious jokes, but I still think that if I'm in a new country, what seems innocent to me might still be innocent to every comic. So you've got to check. It's really funny. I mean, there's a club in Amsterdam, Tumbler, that I play nearly every year. When I first went there, there's a little red light bulb. There's loads of them scattered across the room. And I said, oh, you know, it's a simple little joke. I said, you know, I heard there was a lot of prostitution here, but I didn't realise everyone had their own red light. Now, they looked up, saw these bulbs above their heads, and the audience laughed. And I said to the bartender, has that been said before? He said, no. But a few years later, maybe 5 or 6 years later, I was out there with a comedian called Matt Welcome, and he said, because they're not thinking about the red light district because they lived there all their life. So I suppose that's why it's sometimes easier for an outsider to make a joke, because you're seeing it as an outsider. But it also explained
quite logical.